Greetings, this is Will Evans. We're shifting gears, and our guest today is Mark Weinhold, White River National Forest hydrologist. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
How were you inspired to become a hydrologist, and tell us what they generally do?
Well, I guess I was inspired to become a hydrologist from just a lot of outdoor activity when we were young. My dad was very outdoor-oriented, so we did lots of fishing and hiking and some hunting. And in Western Oregon, where I grew up, you're always near a river, so that seemed to be a pretty large part of our recreation.
And you just recently returned from a year in Korea. What did you learn there about the water?
Well, we were in Korea. My wife actually took a teaching position there, and the kids went to high school in an international school. And I guess what I learned about water in Korea, and probably Southeast Asia added to that because we traveled around a bit, is that we're pretty fortunate where we are and that we can drink water out of the tap. And those countries in that part of the world can't do that. We have a lot of clean drinking water and are pretty effective at treating water for drinking purposes.
And you were going to say more about what a hydrologist does, and then you could tell us maybe specifically what a forest hydrologist, which is what you are, what you do.
Well, a forest hydrologist, and then I guess I'll address what I know best, and that's hydrologists for the Forest Service, that you have to consider that national forests are multiple-use lands, so a lot of things can happen. It might be a timber sale, it might be grazing, it might be a developed ski area. All those things that can and are permitted to happen on national forests, somebody has to look out for the different resources when those projects are proposed, and we call those interdisciplinary teams. And so somebody is representing wildlife, and somebody represents fisheries, and I happen to represent the water aspect of it.
And what are some of the responsibilities that come under water for you in this area in the White River National Forest?
You mean geographically?
Well, both geographically and in terms of specific responsibilities.
Well, I guess in terms of responsibilities, we have ultimately whatever we do on national forests has to meet the law. And when I say the law, typically we're talking about the Clean Water Act as it filters down through state water quality standards and then into our forest plan. So essentially, whatever activity we do on the forest has to meet the law, which means it has to be consistent with our forest plan. So we're constantly looking at activities, seeing should those happen, and if they do happen, do they need to be mitigated such that we're essentially as well off or better off than when we started in terms of the condition of the water.
Would it be accurate then to say you're the water guardian of the forest?
I guess I would say that I'm one of them. I think a lot of people actually are guardians. I do it on paper with a couple other folks in our office.
And we probably need all the ones we can get.
That's true.
So what does water mean to you now, and what did it mean to you when you started?
Well, I guess when I started, and I'd say when I started being a kid, water was a source of recreation and something cold to drink on a hot day. But as I've gotten older and actually spent more time in the water business, so to speak, it certainly takes on a bigger role. And I think at some point you start to realize that what a huge role water plays in our everyday life, from our health. Literally, we're made mostly of water, to still recreation and all those sorts of things. Water is key to all that we do.
And what can you tell us about the nature of water, the element itself?
The element itself, I think most people know H2O, so a couple pieces of hydrogen and oxygen, so we've got a molecule, but That's kind of the mundane aspect. I think the more interesting and magical aspect of water is that it can be three things. It can be a liquid, it can be a solid, and it could be a gas. And it travels all over the world in different phases, and that's pretty unique.
And that solid actually floats, which is kind of unusual for solids.
Yeah, it is a little different. That's what keeps the ice cubes floating in your glass of water, I guess.
Keeps them at the top.
Yeah.
And how do you connect and relate to water? Is it mostly mathematical, or how do you How do you keep your balance in working with law?
Well, I think my educational background certainly comes from the quantitative side. So I've spent most of my life in hydraulic engineering, actually, which is definitely the mathematical side of water. Although when you're in the water management or the land management business, as we are with the Forest Service, it takes on a little more global nature than simply mechanistic aspects of water. And you're looking at basically how water affects the landscape, how it affects all the people that use the forest and downstream from the forest. So it's definitely a bigger picture when you're talking about management, especially.
Well, and this valley is so water-oriented, from its solid form we ski on to fishing and playing on it and in it, as well as drinking it and using to irrigate our crops.
Right. And I think, you know, that kind of laundry list is ultimately what the people in our valley need to be aware of, because it's really an important aspect of what we have here and what we do here.
So we had a lot of red dust blow in this spring from the west. What was the effect of that dust on the snow?
Well, I'm sure a lot of people saw that, especially the skiers saw that. And essentially what happens is, when the sun is out, the solar radiation, it actually reflects off the snow, and your snowpack is able to persist for quite some time. But when there's something like dust on the surface, it essentially creates a dark surface that absorbs that energy instead of reflecting it. So what we would see is that our snowpack would go away a whole lot quicker than it might otherwise do when it's got dust on it.
And we had a faster runoff this year.
Right. Right. And what that means is we lose a lot of water from the landscape pretty quickly. And we would typically like to see that water sit there in the snowpack and slowly go into the soil and release over the summer, as opposed to coming off in the spring freshet.
So what goes into the air and comes down as either dust or precipitation, that's all connected.
It is all connected. You know, that's why we hear things about acid rain, and that's why we get, dust that comes through. Those things eventually end up being caught by precipitation, or they melt with snow and work their way into the rivers. So they're stuck with water. Water is a transporter of many different things.
And you mentioned acid rain, and I know there's some lakes that get measured regularly. What's the acid rain situation in our area?
Well, the Forest Service, and it's largely in conjunction, I think, with the USGS, we do some air monitoring, essentially, through looking at water quality in high mountain lakes. And that's just an easy way to get at air quality, because those constituents essentially settle out in the lakes, and that's a more reliable way to get a longer term sample of air quality, rather than the equivalent of a grab sample of air and hoping that you're catching something at the right time.
And what's the trend? Are some of our lakes acidifying?
Some of them are. To be honest, I'm not sure. I'm not up on all the results of that. I'd have to go back and look at the USGS data. But we've got many years of data so far, so there's quite a record. But I admit I'm a little bit ignorant of that. Andrea Holland-Sears is our air quality expert in Glenwood Springs, and she would have that at her fingertips.
So what goes up in the air or down the drain, or when we flush the toilet, ultimately comes back in the precipitation we receive?
Well, water, we've all heard of the hydrologic cycle, and water is constantly moving, whether it's in a liquid form or a solid form or gaseous as a vapor. And so it's constantly interacting with the air and the ground. And so it's picking up constituents and leaving them behind at all levels and at all stages in that process.
How much does smoke from fireplaces and wildfires influence the quality of precipitation?
Well, you know, I'm not sure about the particular constituents that are in smoke, but I think if you look at it at a little bigger picture, whether it's smoke or some sort of maybe even industrial pollution in the air, that affects water quality because it's just like acid rain. When precipitation comes down, it takes things out of the air. And I think we've all seen that, particularly in other places in the world maybe, where a nice rain cleans the air. And it cleans the air, but it takes all those things down to ground level, and it might be to the soil or it might be right back into the river.
And what goes into the soil? So air and water and soil are all interlocking circles.
It's one big loop, yeah.
Are there any trends you can see running in precipitation you can tell us about?
Well, I think I don't have any specific numbers, but I think most of the folks are aware of our general trends, and I think you can look down the river at Lake Powell and get the indication that in the last 5-10 years we've had some drought years, and we've had a couple above average precipitation years. You know, last year I think was one of them, maybe a couple years ago, but we've also had those years like 2002 that were way below normal, but. In general, in the last decade or so, we're on the dry side.
Well, do we have enough water then?
Well, I think if you look around this country in particular, nobody is dying from a lack of clean water to drink. But at the same time, population demands more water, and certain aspects and development of population demands more water. And I think As the population in Colorado increases, we will run into more difficulties with the volume of water that we need. And you can look at a lot of rivers within western Colorado now, and they're over-appropriated, which means that the volume of water we expect to come off of there is spoken for. It's committed to some use through a water right. And I just read an article in, I forget, it might have been the Denver Post that Alan Best wrote, and he was talking about by 2035, they're estimating the population of Colorado will go up by about a third. And over that same amount of time, they expect the volume of water available to go down by about 15%. And I suspect that's related to global climate change. And so obviously there's some conflict in the making here.
Well, and some of that conflict's already here. I have people in Dillon who've told me they can't have a garden. They can't have a potted plant on the porch and water it.
Right. And again, as Colorado's a popular place to be, and so expect more of those conflicts as time goes on.
And certainly we know the climate projections say we're much more likely to get more rain and less snow.
Right. And what that means, at least the way we're used to using water now, is obviously most of our demand is in the summertime. And there's a lot of irrigation type demand that goes with that. And our typical precipitation being snowfall in the winter, we actually store that when we don't need it. And then it slowly melts and comes off in the summertime. And we use that water as we change. As climate change and perhaps we shift to a more rain-dominated climate, the rain comes and the rain goes. And if it's coming and going at a time when our irrigation demands, for example, are low, that water, you might view it as essentially lost. I don't think the people downstream of us view it as lost, but it's not available for us to use unless we start some pretty ambitious reservoir projects to start storing water for use in different seasons, which I know is being discussed across the state.
So it's quite likely we could see much drier summers.
Possibly, yeah. And I don't know, the predictions for how climate change would affect Colorado change by basin, and I think there's a lot of effects from topography in there. But when you start going to a rain-dominated climate, in the winter at least, I would expect our flow rates perhaps to be lower in the summer if we're not storing that water as snow.
And you mentioned the article that said potentially available water could go down by a third.
By 15%. Population 15%. Would go up by a third.
Okay, 15%.
Yeah.
I have a question about the tamarisk.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an invasive plant,
right,
that is into the Colorado River drainage and working its way this way. Do you have comments about the tamarisk, and do you have contingency plans as it begins to come further upstream?
Well, the tamarisk is an issue because it, I think it was brought in ultimately to stabilize stream banks, and it does a fantastic job of that, and it basically takes over and excludes all other vegetation. But the issue with it is it uses a tremendous amount of water in transpiration. To be honest, at the forest level, we are so far upstream that we don't have much in the way of tamarisk on ground that we manage. So for the Forest Service on the White River, it really hasn't become an issue.
Is it one that you're informed enough about you can say anything about the future of tamarisk water consumption?
Well, I think in terms of water consumption, the future is now. There's, you know, the Colorado River basically is covered with tamarisk through much of its length. So I know there's been some pretty aggressive, at least proposals in the past, and I think Scott McGinnis talked about it several years ago about, you know, in a decade or so we would be rid of tamarisk, but that's really a tough thing to do, and it takes continued kind of revisits to make it go away.
I know trips I paddle that there used to be multiple nice campsites, and I can't even get out of my boat and get up the bank now. It's so thick with tamarisks.
Oh, yeah. It turns into a jungle. It's not a not easy to walk through.
No. Are there streams in Colorado that have become contaminated and are toxic and poisonous?
There are, and by and large, that's not a byproduct of, you know, for example, industrial waste. Typically, our streams in Colorado, or at least western Colorado, that are lifeless, so to speak, are due to historic mining impacts. And so we've got many miles of stream that are subject to drainage from mines that typically, it's high pH or low pH water, sorry, that will take metals out of the rocks as it flows through it, and so you end up with high metal concentrations. That often it's zinc or manganese, perhaps, that ultimately affect aquatic life in a bad way.
So, if I understand it, then mining that opened up deposits of zinc can alter the pH and make it so acidic that life doesn't really thrive there.
Well, essentially what you're getting is water coming from deep in the ground that has a really low pH. And when we dig these holes deep into the ground and basically provide a spot for this water to come out through the adit or the shaft, however that looks, then we basically have a condition where we need to do something about the quality of that water forever. Because the pH is not going to change on its own coming out of the ground, at least in time frames that we're interested in all likelihood.
And have you had success doing that?
You know, there have been places where that's been done, and I think it's the Penn Mine in Summit County, and they actually built a treatment plant that added the equivalent of lime that was trying to lower the pH of that water. And essentially, on the first go-round, what happened is the machinery kind of rusted to death.
Because the water was so acidic?
Right, right. And now they're looking at different ways to keep that running. But again, we're talking about some sort of treatment process, you know, in perpetuity.
Right.
That can't stop.
Otherwise, there will be no life thriving below that point.
Right, right.
So our culture views water primarily as a commodity. How do you view water?
Well, I think you have to look at it a couple different ways. I kind of look at water, I like to look at it as a little more holistic view because, like I was talking about earlier, it's part of everything that we are, everything that we eat is mostly water. But at the same time, our society does view it as a commodity. So when you are doing land management, for example, you have to look at it in that way, in some sense, to kind of do your evaluation in a way that people can relate to and make sense of.
And there are also people who have real respectful partnerships with water, and some people even view it as sacred.
Right, right. And I think you were mentioning that at one point that Native Americans have that view. I think our culture, you know, some people really relate to water, and those are the people that are out there spending time on the rivers, whether they're fishing or floating or just relaxing, enjoying some peace and quiet. And others, you know, that's just not their thing. They're fairly disconnected from it.
Right.
Except for, you know, turning on the shower in the morning.
The cave above Glenwood is an extraordinary work of water over time in many ways. What can you say about that cave and how it's come to be?
Well, I guess not specifically talking about that cave, but lots of caves and Glenwood Canyon and all those things. I think arguably water is perhaps the strongest force on Earth. You know, you've heard the expression that water always wins, and flowing water has amazing power to erode and change the landscape. It's an incredible geomorphic agent of change. And the fact that we have caves through limestone or we have the Grand Canyon is just testimony to the fact of what water will do with time on its side.
And speaking of water in volume, what has been your experience with floods?
In Colorado, you know, we haven't seen a whole lot of flooding. As I recall, the last big flood around here was probably 95. And at that time, I was in Southwest Oregon. And we had, within a few years, we had a couple hundred-year storms. And those were based on big, big precipitation events coming off the ocean and dumping a huge amount of rain, like 12, 13 inches in a day. And it was a fascinating time to be a hydrologist on the forest because the landscape was coming unraveled in its own way.
I bet.
That, you know, we tend to see that as negative, but that's just how watersheds are, and that's what shaped the landscape that we look at right now. We just see it later with trees on it.
And what were some of the consequences of a 12-inch rain?
Well, there were, you know, I forget the number, but there were probably, on the district that I was working on, that call it a couple hundred thousand acres, that there were probably 50 or 60 significant landslides. Some of those were related to roads, some of them weren't, but the way that we typically tally up damage from those things is to look what happens to our infrastructure on the forest, and by and large, we're talking about roads there, and on that one small district, we had $5 million worth of damage to the road system, which inevitably happened where roads and streams met, where it's stream crossings that typically have a culvert or a bridge underneath them.
And were there any homes in that area, or was it all just forest?
No, it was forest. Certainly down low, when you get into the private lands, there were homes, and some of those that were too close to the river, and the rivers migrated a bit. I have pictures of homes that actually tipped into the creek as the banks eroded from these channels moving around with so much water in them. It actually took houses.
Well, and some of us in Colorado can remember a big flood in what was called Big Thompson Canyon that took out some lives because it came on very suddenly and unexpectedly.
Right. These ones in Western Oregon in particular, we're used to a lot of rain. It's not unusual to get 4, 5, 6 inches of rain. And most people that are in the floodplain are in the process of kind of moving back from the floodplain because water gets up there often enough. So I don't know that anybody died in those floods.
What's important to teach children about water?
I think the important thing to teach children about water, and this would apply not even to water, but kind of every decision that they make in their life, is to get connected, I would say. And by get connected, I mean know where your water comes from. Know where your water goes when you flush the toilet. As far as that goes, know where your food comes from. All those things, if you don't know the answer to simple questions like that, you really don't have a basis for evaluating your activities. Everything we do ultimately has a consequence to where we live. And if you aren't in touch with what's happening, you know, when you take water out of the Roaring Fork for irrigation, perhaps, or to drink, or you're buying food from 200 miles away, those sorts of things, you really don't have a basis to say, boy, I don't think that's the way that's not the footprint I want to make here. So get connected. Know how your bread gets buttered, so to speak.
And be real wary if somebody from the Eastern Slope wants to buy Roaring Fork drainage water.
Yeah, perhaps.
Well,
it might be a little late for that. I think I was looking at some figures a couple years ago about the amount of water that at least have rights to be diverted from the western slope over to the east, and I did the math a couple different ways, and so here I'll ask you a question. If you stacked all that water onto an acre, so about the size of a football field, how high do you think that stack of water that is committed to the east side would be?
In cubic feet, you mean?
No, just how tall it would be if it was an acre in area.
Right.
So about the size of a football field, how tall do you think it would be to get that volume of water?
Oh, gosh, I would guess 10,000 feet.
It's 140 miles.
140 miles?
10,000 feet being about 2 miles. It's 140 miles.
Of
That's
water.
That's the volume of water that is committed to go to the eastern slope from the west side.
And what's the volume that comes down the river?
Oh, you know, I don't know that number off the top of my head. That's a big number. You know, the Colorado is a huge basin.
Sure.
And all the water that is tied up in water rights to go to the east side, I don't think it goes there right now, but ultimately that's the volume that could go over there, which to me is just an interesting way to look at it.
Well, it is, and it's beyond my comprehension.
Yeah, that's quite the tower.
Yes. Wow. This is Will Evans. I've been speaking with Mark Weinhold, hydrologist for the White River National Forest. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.